From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Our national plan launches a full-scale wartime effort to address the supply shortages by ramping up production and protective equipment, syringes, needles, you name it. And when I say wartime, people kind of look at me like, wartime? Well, as I said last night, 400,000 Americans have died. That's more than have died in all of World War II.
President Joe Biden unveils a sweeping COVID strategy after President Trump left no plan for a national vaccine rollout. On his first full day in office, Biden issued 10 executive orders and invoked the Defense and Production Act. We'll speak to Dr. Ashish Jha, head of Brown University's School of Public Health. Then we'll look at the devastating impact of the pandemic on Indigenous communities. We'll go to Standing Rock, where tribal leaders are prioritizing vaccines for elders who speak the Dakota and Lakota languages in an effort to keep the elders and the languages alive.
The language comes from the Creator, so it doesn't belong to one of us. The language belongs to all of us. So my message to all of the young people, the young men, the young women, the boys, the girls, this is your language. When you learn it, you're going to be able to learn more about this beautiful thing called life.
Those are the words of Standing Rock elder Jesse Taken Alive, who died from COVID last month, just weeks after the virus killed his wife. We'll be joined by their daughter, Nola, as well as a Standing Rock elder, and Jody Archambault, a member of the tribe who served in the Obama White House. Plus, we look at new calls for Biden to shut down the Dakota Access Pipeline after he revoked a permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On his first full day in office, President Joe Biden unveiled a 198-page national plan to tackle the coronavirus pandemic, calling it a wartime undertaking against COVID-19. Adding to the urgency, the U.S. recorded another near-record global high death toll Thursday with over 4,100 deaths. Biden signed 10 executive orders to create a new national COVID-19 testing board to help schools reopen, to mandate international travelers to quarantine upon arrival, and to mandate masks on many forms of interstate transportation.
Our plan starts with mounting an aggressive, safe, and effective vaccination campaign to meet our goal of administering 100 million shots in our first 100 days in office. We're on day one. This will be one of the greatest operational challenges our nation has ever undertaken.
On Thursday, the nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, spoke to reporters at the White House. He was asked about the difference between working under Presidents Trump and Biden.
The idea that you can get up here and talk about what you know, what the evidence, what the science is, and know that's it. Let the science speak. It is somewhat of a liberating feeling.
Here in New York, vaccination clinics have been canceling appointments and turning away seniors as supplies of Pfizer and Moderna COVID-19 vaccines dwindle. It's a scene that's been repeated across the United States. This is New York City Council member Mark Levine.
Because of the unreliability of supply, the city had to cancel tens of thousands of appointments this week. This is a desperate situation. At the pace at which we are receiving vaccine, it would take us well into 2022 to achieve herd immunity in New York City. That's unacceptable.
On Thursday, President Biden invoked the Defense Production Act to increase COVID-19 testing and the production of vaccine supplies, including glass vials and syringes. Many public health experts are calling on Biden to use his executive powers to demand that vaccine makers share their patented technologies with other manufacturers in order to end production bottlenecks and speed the vaccine to people across the U.S. and around the world. After headlines, we'll have the latest on the pandemic and Joe Biden's response from Dr. Ashish Jha, head of Brown University's School of Public Health. In international news, Chinese officials are rushing construction of a massive quarantine facility outside Beijing that can temporarily house more than 4,000 people in isolation. Cities in northern China that are home to millions of people entered lockdown earlier this month as authorities tried to stamp out several small coronavirus outbreaks. The lockdowns come ahead of the Chinese Lunar New Year, an annual holiday that normally sees hundreds of millions of people travel within China to visit family. Portugal has the world's highest seven-day average rate of new COVID-19 cases and the second highest per capita death rate. The surge is wreaking havoc with Portugal's presidential election Sunday. In India, a massive fire at the Serum Institute of India killed five people Thursday. The institute is the world's largest producer of vaccines, though officials said the blaze did not affect production of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine. Meanwhile, Hungary's become the first European Union member nation to give emergency use authorization to Russia's Sputnik COVID-19 vaccine. President Biden has proposed a five-year extension with Russia to the only remaining nuclear treaty between the two countries before it expires February 5th. The new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or New START, limits the number of deployed strategic nuclear warheads to 1,550 each. This is White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
The New START Treaty is in the national security interests of the United States, and this extension makes even more sense when the relationship with Russia is adversarial, as it is at this time.
This comes as the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons goes into effect today. The UN-backed agreement was ratified by 51 countries, but those do not include any of the world's nine nuclear powers: Britain, China, France, India, Israel, North Korea, Pakistan, Russia, and the United States. Lawmakers on Thursday overwhelmingly approved a waiver allowing retired Army General Lloyd Austin to become Pentagon chief. Austin left the military 4 years ago, now serves on the board of weapons maker Raytheon. Normally, a minimum of 7 years is required before taking the civilian job, unless a waiver is granted from both houses of Congress. Many of the House Democrats who voted for the waiver opposed a waiver for President Trump's first Pentagon chief pick, retired Marine General Jim Mattis. The Senate could vote on Austin's confirmation as soon as today. If confirmed, he would become the first African-American defense secretary. Meanwhile, Biden will keep FBI Director Christopher Wray, who was appointed by Trump in 2017, in his position. In other news from Biden's administration, the president has appointed Jessica Rosenworcel as the acting chair of the Federal Communications Commission. Digital rights activists praise the move, pointing to her record at the commission, which includes supporting net neutrality, treating the internet as a public utility, and increasing access for underserved populations. In a setback for Palestinian rights, Secretary of State nominee Tony Blinken said during his confirmation hearing this week that the Biden administration will not reverse Trump's contested move of the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, also recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Palestinian journalist Lama Khatar tweeted, quote, "Everything is subject to change in the agendas of successive U.S. administrations except for absolute loyalty to Israel," they wrote. Senate Democrats have rejected a proposal by Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell to preserve the 60-vote legislative filibuster as part of a power-sharing agreement. Democrats are seeking to prevent a minority of senators from derailing ambitious legislation like President Biden's proposed $1.9 trillion coronavirus rescue package. McConnell's threatened to block an organizing resolution laying out rules and committee assignments for the new Senate session unless Democrats agree to maintain the filibuster. Meanwhile, Senator McConnell called on Democrats Thursday to delay former President Trump's impeachment trial until February in order to give Trump's legal team more time to prepare. His call came as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she would send the article of impeachment to the Senate soon.
The fact is, the President of the United States committed an act of incitement of insurrection. I don't think it's very unifying to say, oh, let's just forget it and move on.
Several Senate Democrats have filed an ethics complaint against Republican Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley over their role in inciting the deadly January 6th insurrection at the Capitol and seeking to overturn the results of the 2020 election. The complaint seeks an investigation into whether Cruz, Hawley, or any of the senators' staffers were in contact with organizers of the riot or helped to coordinate their actions. This comes as federal agents in Michigan have arrested former U.S. Michael Joseph Foy for assaulting a federal officer and other charges related to the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Video appears to show Foy using a hockey stick to repeatedly bash a prone police officer who is dragged into a violent mob trying to push its way inside the Capitol. NPR reports nearly one in five people charged over the January 6th attack are U.S. military veterans. A coalition of 135 civil rights organizations is calling on Congress not to pass new anti-terrorism laws in the wake of the January 6th attacks, warning they could be used to expand racial profiling or to surveil communities of color and political opponents in the name of national security. Wade Henderson of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights said, quote, "The government's inadequate response to rising white nationalism is a disgraceful policy failure. The problem is hardly new, and prosecutors have long had a multitude of criminal statutes at their disposal to confront white supremacist violence," unquote. To see our interview with the ACLU, you can go to democracynow.org. In immigration news, the Biden administration suspended the controversial Trump-era Remain in Mexico program. The 2019 policy forced tens of thousands of asylum seekers to wait in dangerous conditions in crowded, squalid refugee camps across northern Mexico while their cases make their way through U.S. courts. This is asylum seeker Marlene speaking to the advocacy group Puebla Sin Fronteras, that's People Without Borders, about facing homelessness with her family after being sent to Mexico.
We vividly remember when we arrived to the immigration office in Mexico. They didn't give us a place to sleep or anything to eat. Our children slept on the floor that night.
President Biden set to sign an executive order today, speeding delivery of food aid and millions of stimulus checks to families struggling to afford rent, utilities and groceries. On Thursday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said lawmakers would move immediately on a new COVID-19 relief bill, with House passage likely in early February. In labor news, the grocery delivery app Instacart's laying off nearly 2,000 workers, including a group of employees from Illinois who created the first and only union of Instacart workers and inspired others across the country to organize. The 10 Illinois employees were in the process of negotiating their first union contract. Instacart's reportedly offering fired workers severance pay of just $250. In New York, Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez skipped President Biden's inauguration celebrations Wednesday evening to join striking workers at the Hunts Point produce market in the Bronx. Workers have been on strike since Sunday, demanding better wages. This is Ocasio-Cortez speaking at the picket line outside Hunts Market.
When you're standing on this line, you're not just asking for a dollar. You are asking for transformational change for your lives and for the lives of every food worker across this country, for kids of food workers across this country, because there's a lot of things upside down right now in our economy.
And union members at the New Yorker magazine went on a 24-hour strike Thursday after denouncing, quote, management's egregious wage proposal in their ongoing contract talks. According to the union, the wage proposal includes the right to decrease union members' salaries by up to 20% at any time. In a statement, unionized employees wrote, quote, "We're committed to the New Yorker, which why many of us work there for years, even decades, despite low and stagnant wages. However much we may love our jobs, that love is not enough to live on," they wrote. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On his first full day in office, President Biden unveiled a 198-page national plan to tackle the coronavirus pandemic and ramp up vaccines as the U.S. death toll tops 410,000. This comes after President Trump left Biden with no plan for a national vaccine rollout. Biden signed 10 executive orders to create a new national COVID-19 testing board to help schools reopen, to mandate international travelers to quarantine upon arrival, and to require masks on many forms of interstate transportation. Another order creates a COVID-19 health equity task force. Biden also invoked the Defense Production Act to increase COVID-19 testing and the production of vaccine supplies.
Today, I'm signing an executive action to use the Defense Production Act and all other available authorities to direct all federal agencies and private industry to accelerate the making of everything that needs to protect, test, vaccinate, and take care of our people.
President Biden said a wartime effort is needed to combat the virus.
Our national plan launches a full-scale wartime effort to address the supply shortages by ramping up production and protective equipment, syringes, needles, you name it. And when I say wartime, people kind of look at me like, wartime? Well, as I said last night, 400,000 Americans have died. That's more than have died in all of World War II. We will make sure that scientists and public health experts will speak directly to you. That's why you're going to hear a lot more from Dr. Fauci again. Not from the president, but from the real, genuine experts and scientists. We're going to make sure they work free from political interference and they make decisions strictly based on science and healthcare alone. Science and health alone, not what the political consequences are. The honest truth is, we're still in a dark winter of this pandemic. It's going to get worse before it gets better. It's going to take many months to get where we need to be.
On Thursday, the nation's top infectious disease doctor, Anthony Fauci, spoke to reporters at the White House and was asked about the difference between working under President Trump and President Biden.
I don't want to be going back, you know, over history, but it was very clear that there were things that were said, be it regarding things like hydroxychloroquine and other things like that, that really was uncomfortable because they were not based on scientific fact. I can tell you, I take no pleasure at all in being in a situation of contradicting the president. So it was really something that you didn't feel that you could actually say something and there wouldn't be any repercussions about it. The idea that you can get up here and talk about what you know, what the evidence, what the science is, and know that's it. Let the science speak. It is somewhat of a liberating feeling.
To talk more about the Biden administration's COVID plan, we're joined by Dr. Ashish Jha, dean of the Brown University School of Public Health, previously the director of Harvard University's Global Health Institute. Dr. Jha, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Can you respond to this series of executive orders that President Biden has just unveiled and signed in his first days in office? What is most significant?
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for having me on. You know, if you look at the whole package of activities, it just feels like the federal government is back. The federal government is going to play a constructive and helpful role in this pandemic and the pandemic response. And that's critical because the strategy under the Trump team was let every state figure it out on their own and the federal government was largely absent. There's a series of things here that I think are really important. One of them that has got very little attention is the executive order just to start collecting data in a more systematic way. You know, data is the lifeblood of any pandemic response, and we have been hampered by lack of good federal data. We're going to start doing that. But obviously, there's so much more than that. Rejoining WHO, getting our Defense Production Act powers for testing and vaccinations. So I'm pretty pleased with the whole package. It's straightforward. It's basic public health. I don't mean to denigrate it by calling it basic public health, but it's sort of science-driven stuff that I wish we had had a year ago.
So let's talk about what's happening right now in this country. You have, what, more than 900,000 vaccines being administered every day, which sounds like a lot, but in fact is not. Here in New York, people are waiting in the freezing cold hour after hour to get a vaccine. They'll sign up for an appointment. They'll get an appointment for a pass date, or they'll get an appointment, and then that appointment is canceled. Clearly, running out of vaccines, not only in New York, but around the country. Can you explain what the use of the Defense Production Act, what so many were calling on Trump to invoke month after month, what it actually could mean? Could companies and factories that have been closed down, this also involves employment for people, going back to FDR, a kind of entire public program of actually making these vaccines or parts of the vaccines, either the chemicals or the actual, not only the ingredients, but the what's needed in making the needles and the vaccines?
Yeah, absolutely. So, first of all, the reason we're having those long lines and canceled appointments is because of the approach that the Trump administration took through Operation Warp Speed. Operation Warp Speed did have its successes, but also in the last month, they did a terrible job of communicating to states how many vaccines people were going to get. So states would be told, okay, you're going to get 100,000 vaccines, in 5 days, and then 2 days before the delivery, that would be canceled or would be changed. Made planning for this stuff incredibly difficult. What the Defense Production Act can definitely do is help with all of the things that go into getting a vaccine into somebody's arms. So it's not just about the vaccine ingredient itself. It is about the vials. It is about the syringes. The way that these vials are filled, we can often get an extra dose out of them if we have the right vial and the right syringe for this. Just really simple, basic stuff that the Trump administration paid very little attention to, Mr. Biden's team, President Biden's team, has been very clear that they're going to maximize every single thing. I think the question of can we use the DPA to somehow make a lot more vaccines turns out to be a far trickier question, something I've delved pretty deeply into. The problem there is that these are complicated vaccines to make, and you can't just have somebody else step in and make these mRNA vaccines without a lot of technical expertise and very specialized equipment, much of which comes from countries outside the United States. A lot of it comes from Germany, for instance. So there are going to be challenges to ramping up a lot more production. I do think the Biden team is definitely going to try to do that. We will see what's possible, but there are going to be some technical limitations that'll make it hard for us to, let's just say, start producing tens of millions of these vaccines every day. I think that's not going to be possible just because of technical challenges.
I mean, it raises very interesting questions when it's not only the United States, but a massive shortage in the world of vaccines. I think, was it the World Health Organization said of the 46 countries that are now vaccinating their populations at whatever speed, only one of them is a low-income country. So these vaccines have to get out all over. I was just going back years in Health Affairs, the magazine, to an article that talked about a little-known law codified as 28 U.S.C. Section 1498 that could allow the federal government to substantially lower prices for high-cost drugs, allowing the government the right to use patented inventions without permission while paying the patent holder reasonable and entire compensation. The article assesses the potential for the federal government to invoke it to make important new high-cost therapies widely available to patients. Now, this is well before the pandemic, and you're saying, well, it's difficult, but you already have, is it the factory in Belgium that they had to stop because they had big problems with the manufacture of the vaccine? I mean, there are factories all over the country that have been shut down. Pushing harder on this, is it that, well, they have to be just made very carefully, or because of the, you know, capitalist system that we work in, that it there is this sort of sacrosanct, we will not challenge the purview of these corporations when there is such a lack of necessary vaccine right now that so many hundreds of thousands of people are dying?
Yeah, so there are several points here, Amy, that are worth taking apart. I mean, one certainly is that we have got to have a global strategy. I mean, this is one of the many atrocious sort of policies of the Trump administration was we were the only major country, I guess, along with Russia, that wasn't part of COVAX. COVAX is the global effort to get vaccinations out to people around the world. We absolutely need to rejoin COVAX, and the Biden administration has made clear that they will. Second is that there is a whole host of vaccines that are going to be possible. There's the AstraZeneca, there's Johnson & Johnson should be coming. We should see some data from them, I think, in the next few days. So we're going to really need a global strategy. On the issue of patents, The issue in my mind is I don't think that the Biden administration is going to let Americans die because of a desire not to infringe patents. I think the challenge there, and if you think about it from a Moderna or a Pfizer point of view, if there were other companies that could make their product, they'd be happy to license it. There are mechanisms for doing this. I think they'd feel a lot of pressure from the U.S. government to do so. I really do believe there are capacity issues on this that are not unsolvable, but I think there's been no effort to try to solve them from the previous team. And what I expect Dr. Kessler, who's going to be running Operation Warp Speed, and others in the Biden administration, is to look into those questions to say, how do we put the power of the federal government towards ramping up production of these specific vaccines? And the one last thing I will say about these vaccines is because they are technically complicated, you have to be very, very careful about making sure the quality is good. And that's not my way of saying only Moderna or Pfizer can do it. I think lots of companies can, but we've got to be careful that we don't end up messing up the really high quality of these vaccines that are so important to keeping people confident that the vaccines are going to be safe and effective. So I think all of this is going to be looked at, but there are a set of challenges here that go beyond patent laws.
Dr. Ashish Jha, you've written an article. It's time to consider delaying the second dose of coronavirus vaccine. It's an op-ed that was in The Washington Post. So on what science are you basing this? We all know that both Moderna and Pfizer won't be true with Johnson & Johnson, the one shot. It requires two shots. Why do you think you can get away with one shot? Usually people have a reaction to the second shot, which is, what, about a month later, which suggests that bolster shot is the one, the booster shot, is the one that basically kicks up the reaction and the immunity.
Yeah. So as the title says, it's time to consider delaying the second shot, not foregoing the second shot. Everybody needs two shots. There's no doubt about that in my mind. If you look at the data from the clinical trials, both from Moderna and Pfizer, it's also very clear that one shot provides about 80 to 90% protection, at least until the second shot is given. And the question in front of us is, in a normal situation, would we even think about delaying a second shot? No. We would just give everybody their second shot on time. But the question that I and my colleague Bob Wachter, who co-wrote this with me, what we did is we spoke to a large number of immunologists, vaccinologists, and asked the question, if we delay the second shot by a few weeks, let's say instead of giving it at week four, we gave it at week six or week eight, what are the chances that the protection from the first shot would somehow wane dramatically after 4 weeks? Because, again, you do have that 80 to 90% protection after the first shot. Everybody agreed that that is extremely unlikely, that you could delay it by at least a few weeks. And so our idea was, we have a set of vaccines sitting on shelves. Let's get them out into people's arms. Let's assume, because we've done the checking, that the production of the vaccines will continue to go well. And then as the new vaccines come off the production line, get everybody their second shot. And let's do this particularly for high-risk individuals, older people, people with chronic diseases. I would rather have all of those folks have their first shot. And most of them will get their second shot on time. And if a few end up getting a little bit delayed, in my mind, that is not a particularly risky thing based on the data and science. But what we know, Amy, is that if we don't do that, and if we don't vaccinate more people, given the variant, the UK variant, that is circulating in the US that I think has all of us extremely concerned, we are looking at another 100,000 Americans dead in the next 4 to 6 weeks. And we're looking at things even getting worse after that. That's the alternative. And so in that context, this felt like it was both science-based and it would not put people at risk to delay things by a few weeks. Definitely not forego it. Definitely not delay it by many months.
I'm trying to cram in so many questions, and I know you have to go in a minute, Dr. Jha. So on Thursday, President Biden signed the executive order to form a COVID-19 health equity task force.
Today, I'm formalizing the Health Equity Task Force that we announced in the transition, led by the brilliant Dr. Marcella Nunez-Smith, who ensures that is going to ensure that equality is at the core of every decision we make. That includes addressing vaccine hesitancy and building trust in communities, as well as fighting disinformation campaigns that are already underway.
I don't think people understood, Dr. Jha, that information on who was getting sick, who was dying the most, was actually not being kept for months. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. So when I started off earlier saying that one of the things, the executive orders I'm most pleased about is just collecting better data, it took us months to figure out that this pandemic was disproportionately impacting communities of color, people of color. One could say you could have predicted it given our known structural inequities in our society, but we didn't know. And we didn't see it until the data became clear much later. I think what we're going to see from the Equity Task Force is far better systematic data collection, making sure that our policies on vaccinations and testing don't leave behind people who are disproportionately being impacted. I'm very pleased to see this. We'll see where the Equity Task Force goes. But there's important work to do here to make sure that as we climb
and very
out
quickly,
because
we're almost a minute
along.
Over, very quickly. Are the variants going to lead to non-immunity with these vaccines?
I think that's pretty unlikely. I think certainly the UK variant looks like the vaccine is going to be effective. There is some questioning about that with the South Africa variant. But I remain very optimistic that the vaccines will be effective against the variants we have. But we've got to get people vaccinated because we don't want to keep pushing our luck and having more variants pop up. The best way to stop more variants is to get the pandemic under control.
Dr. Ashish Shah, thanks so much for being with us. Dean of the Brown University School of Public Health, previously director of the Harvard University Global Health Institute. This is Democracy Now!, speaking about health equity. When we come back, we're going to North Dakota, to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, to talk about the decision the leaders made there to vaccinate the elders who are the keepers of the language, so not only the elders don't die, but that the languages don't die with them. Stay with us.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now the Lord has promised good to me. His word, my hope secures. He will.
That's Nurse Lori Marie Key of Livonia, Michigan, singing Amazing Grace Tuesday night during the COVID National Memorial at the Reflecting Pool. She sings in her hospital, and so the President, Biden, asked her to come and sing for the country. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the coronavirus death toll in the United States passes 410,000, and the vaccine rollout continues shakily across the country, we spend the rest of the hour looking at the fight to save tribal elders and native language speakers who've been devastated by the virus. Facing woefully inadequate health care, lack of government support, and the living legacy of centuries of colonialism, tribal communities have faced staggering losses as COVID-19 rips through Indian country. Native Americans have died at least twice the rate of white people across the United States. Pillars of tribal communities have been lost, along with their knowledge of native languages. Jason Salzman, a spokesperson for the Muscogee Creek Nation, told the New York Times the losses were akin to a cultural book burning. To combat this crisis, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has prioritized elders who speak the Dakota and Lakota languages to receive the COVID vaccine. This is Tribal Health Director Margaret Gates speaking in December.
We had met with tribal council, and at the request of leadership as well, we added in the 65 and older and fluent speakers to be sort of first in line, because usually they will come down in the sea, but we've bumped them up to the top because they are our most important asset to our tribe and our people because of the language.
For more on this critical issue, we're joined by three guests. In Bismarck, North Dakota, Jody Archambault is with us. She's a citizen of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and the former special assistant to President Obama for Native American Affairs for the White House Domestic Policy Council. In Manderson, South Dakota, Alex White Plume is the former vice president and president of the Oglala Sioux Tribe of Pine Ridge Reservation. He's a Lakota interpreter. And in Standing Rock, North Dakota, Nola Taken Alive is a member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Council. Both of her parents recently died of COVID-19. Her father, Standing Rock Sioux Elder Jesse J. Taken Alive, was a fluent Lakota speaker and an ardent defender of the language spoken by only 2,000 people. He was just 65. We welcome all of you to Democracy Now! Nola, our condolences on the loss of both of your parents. If you can talk about them with us, share their life stories.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on. It's my pleasure to speak about my parents. But first of all, I want to send my condolences out to those people who have also lost family members and relatives and loved ones to this ugly virus. But it's my honor, again, to speak about my parents. And I want to say that my parents were very humble people. And to be able to speak about them, I will try to do my best. My parents, I lost my mother in November of 2020. And about a month later, I lost our father to the virus as well. They played a very important role, not only in my siblings and our family's lives, but also to the entire community of Standing Rock. And, you know, those would also say how important my dad's role had played in all of Indian country and all of probably North and South Dakota, with his wisdom, his knowledge of the Lakota language, of treaties, of humanity, just the human issues of, you know, that my dad would bring to the forefront, you know, especially about healing. And my dad was the hugest advocate of not only the importance of being Lakota or understanding, you know, who we are as a people and the huge losses that we have suffered since, you know, time immemorial. But, you know, he continued to believe, and even to his last breath, you know, people will label him as a spiritual warrior, which he was. Both my parents were.
But Nola, I wanted to share the words of your father. This is Jesse Taken Alive speaking directly to young people about preserving the Lakota language.
The language comes from the Creator, so it doesn't belong to one of us. The language belongs to all of us. So my message to all of the young people, the young men, the young women, the boys, the girls, this is your language. When you learn it, you're going to be able to learn more about this beautiful thing called life, because that comes from Wakantaka, the opportunity to share your feelings, to share your thoughts, to express yourself. Comes with our language, and I ask you to take the courage. I believe that there will be a day that all of you will talk. Hey, dona we koska la kana wea dona e apetu nji e nija wa kanje we chalo hakte to han trupi hatanash la kote api e otro ke nach onkte. Finally, in closing, I ask you to do this on behalf of all of us who are older than you. Take the courage to learn the language.
Jesse taken alive, who, together with his wife, Cheryl, were both came down with COVID and died in the last months. When was your dad and mom diagnosed, Nola?
I believe it started out in the middle of October. My dad was diagnosed first, and then about a week and a half later, my mom was diagnosed, and they fought hard, and, you know, they tried to stay with us, but, you know, it's a tough virus, so.
I wanted to bring Jody Archambault into this conversation. She worked in the Obama White House, also is the sister of the former tribal chair, David Archambault of the Standing Rock Sioux. She's speaking to us from Bismarck. You were the special assistant to President Obama for Native American Affairs for the White House Domestic Policy Council. Talk about the policy of the Standing Rock Sioux around the issue of elders and keepers of the language.
Well, I think that every tribe has the ability to prioritize and make preferences for who receives the virus first. And knowing that—
You mean the vaccine first?
The vaccine, yeah, the vaccine, sorry. Knowing that there were a lot of elders who were at really, really high risk, this was a concern from the very beginning, from the onset of COVID. And I think that it took the leadership of the chairman, the tribal council, to understand from just going over the previous year's losses and what has happened throughout the time. And I'm just really proud of them, because this is something that is in the decision-making powers of every tribal nation across the country. Mm.
And I wanted to ask Nola Taken Alive first about your name, Taken Alive, your family's name, if you can talk about the origins of it. And then you're a member of the tribal council that decided to prioritize the elders who speak the Dakota and Lakota languages. And I'm wondering if you could respond to—you could tell us about the community response to that. But begin with your name, Taken Alive.
Well, I think that there's a couple of stories that originate back to our last name, Taken Alive. One of those stories being that a long time ago, one of our ancestors was what you would call a police officer, or take those in who would, you know, do such wrongdoings in the community, and would instead of killing them, would take them alive. So it wasn't a thing where we held that in honor as far as killing people. So that was one of the stories. As far as prioritizing our elders, we want to make sure, and this is something that Dad always talked about, you know, as far as our language, and he'll always say that our language is spiritual. When we talk about spiritual, we talk about our identity of who we are. And, you know, it must be known that throughout the world that Native Americans or American Indians weren't granted Freedom of Religion Act until 1978. So if you can think about that, I was only 1 year old, where our ancestors or my parents, my grandparents, could actually pray and use our ceremonies in the open. Before that, it was outlawed. So with our ceremonies also was our language. And also, we have to look back at the oppression that has happened to our people for generations, for centuries. And it's, you know, you think back 1 year old, you know, it wasn't, you know, until the late, I want to say 70s, early 80s, when my dad actually, you know, he grew up speaking the Lakota language since he was born, you know, it was his first language, but he actually didn't start practicing our ceremonial ways until he was in his mid-20s, late 20s, because of, you know, how that 1978, again, you know, goes back to, you know, being able to openly and freely practice who we were or who we are. And so I just want to reiterate that, because not, you know, not all of the world understands where we are, that we even belong here or that we even exist. And I think our people have been romanticized. As far as, you know, do you still live in teepees? Do you still, you know, but, you know, honestly, you know, my dad, I really am proud of him. You know, my dad was a Lakota language teacher up until his passing at the McLaughlin School. And he actually taught from his teepee. He actually, you know, he lived in a house, but he set up his teepee outside of his house, and he would set up his laptop and, you know, ran his extension cord and made sure that that spirit of the language, you know, through the teepee, through, because he always reiterated that the language is spiritual. So being in connection with the earth, being in connection with everything around him, he wanted to make sure that, you know, he was teaching, you know, that he was passing his knowledge on to the younger generations. So I'm really proud of that, you know, and that was just up until October. My dad was still teaching from his teepee.
I wanted to bring Alex Whiteplume into this conversation, the former vice president and president of the Oglala Sioux Tribe of Pine Ridge Reservation, speaking to us from South Dakota. He is a Lakota interpreter. If you can talk about the effects of COVID-19 on your community, particularly the elders and the keepers of the culture and the language, you are an interpreter, what this means for the Lakota and Dakota languages.
Sure. Good morning to everybody. I was really shocked last January when we first time we heard this COVID. And so my wife and I decided to isolate. And as we sat here on our land, we live out on the land. We don't live up in the housing or built up areas. Certain things happened. They implemented a curfew. And then a while later, they introduced a lockdown, where we were like prisoners in our own house. And me personally, I served 4 years in Berlin, Germany with the U.S. Army. I went to the German museum that they made for the Jews that they killed. And they had to have two forms of ID, one sewed on the jacket and another paper. And a few years ago, the United States passed a law where we had to have two forms of ID. So I was just sitting here and the impact on that lockdown to me was real frightening. I think they was too extreme. It seemed to me like they could have come up with more testing, bring more doctors, health people in, and go house to house and test everybody. And if someone's sick, isolate them there. But instead, we were locked down like we were in prison. And psychologically, that really had an impact on a lot of us people, that we really knew we weren't living free the way we're supposed to, but we're living in a like a prisoner of war camp. So it was really had a negative impact on many of us. On the Pine Ridge Reservation, about 90% of us can't find employment. We're unemployed. Imagine 17 people living in a house with no food, their electricity is ready to get turned off, and then you're locked down. And then the tribe never went to pay the electric company's bills, so lights were being turned off. It was really a negative impact on us. At the same time, many Lakota speakers were just dying from this new disease. We didn't know how it came here. We live out in the open, on the plains. We're not close to any built-up cities. But some of our people might have went to the towns and caught it and came home, and that's how it spread on the reservation. So there's a real scary time for most of us here on the Pine Ridge Reservation.
Alex Whiteplume, you're planning to teach Lakota to children. Can you talk about the importance of teaching Lakota to more members of the tribe and why you feel this is so critical?
Sure. my wife had a school. She started an Amos Freedom School. And so we always taught culture. She taught them how to pick cherries, berries, turnips, how to butcher buffalo meat, how to tan hides. And she was just bringing them up culturally. And the language was really predominant. That's the one we needed to learn. And I'll share a story about how I asked to marry her. I was sitting at the house, and her grandfather's name was Mark Bigroad. And we spoke Lakota, so we were sitting in the living room and just enjoying a discussion, and she was sitting at the table. So in Lakota, I asked Uncle Mark, how do you ask a woman to marry you in Lakota? And he just laughed and laughed, and she kind of looked up at me with one eye, and he said, you know, you can't take a woman and own her. You can't declare her your wife. Our Lakota women are matriarchs, and they have power that you can't control. And so I recommend to you that you sing a beautiful song, and if she likes the song, maybe she'll marry you. So at the table, she was sitting, I looked at her, and as I sang a song that I knew. And here she looked at me, and she says, okay, White Plume, I'll take you for my man. And so what Uncle Mark described was, the description of marriage is called Tchawi Chutchum. Tchawi Chutchum. Tcha means his. We is the sun. Chu, you take part of the sun to create life. That is our definition of married people, two people living together. And that's so important. It's so different from the word married. You say my wife like you own a woman. That's just contrary to Lakota belief. So therefore, the Lakota language is real important. It's a natural language that evolved over millions of years with many different other species that were existing at the time.
We have to break, but we're going to come back to talk about what's happening with the Dakota Access Pipeline, with President Biden stopping the building of Keystone XL, but not DAPL. And Alex, I'd like you to stay with us, because I want you to tell us about your late wife, the Lakota water and land defender, Deborah White Plume. And also, I'd like to ask Jody Archambault to stay with us to understand why now Biden is making a distinction, has separated the Keystone XL from the Dakota Access Pipeline. This is Democracy Now! I want to thank, and once again, our deepest condolences, Nola, on the death of your mother and your father. But clearly, their legacy continues and lives on. Nola, taken alive, speaking to us from the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. Alex White Plume in South Dakota, Jody Archambault in Bismarck, North Dakota. Stay with us. We'll be back in 30 seconds. Song for Mother Earth by Lakota. This is Democracy Now!, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On his first day in office, President Joe Biden issued an executive order to shut down the Keystone XL pipeline. Indigenous and climate justice groups are now urging him to do the same with the Dakota Access Pipeline. DAPL transports 500,000 barrels of crude oil each day. Still with us, Jody Archambault, citizen of Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, former special assistant to President Obama for Native American Affairs for the White House Domestic Policy Council. Also with us, Alex White Plume, former vice president and president of the Oglala Sioux Tribe of the Pine Ridge Reservation, a Lakota interpreter who just lost his wife, Deb White Plume, who we're going to learn about. Jody Archambault, can you talk about this distinction, why you understand Keystone XL was stopped, but not Dakota Access Pipeline, and what your demands are?
I don't understand the distinction that the Biden administration is making, because the pipeline is illegal. Dakota Access Pipeline is an illegal pipeline. It was stated in the lower, the D.C. District Court, that it violated NEPA and the easement was revoked. And so basically the Energy Transfer Partners in the Dakota Access Pipeline, they are trespassing. They're encroaching on federal lands right now. Joe Biden, President Biden, has the discretion to comply with the law, which is NEPA. He has the grounds to make this decision, and it's not that hard. He has a lot of, if he's worried about the legality of it, he's covered because this has been litigated. The best thing that he can do is drop the appeals to this and stop the oil from flowing now.
I wanted to now bring back in Alex Whiteplume to ask about your wife and her legacy. Lakota Water and Land Defender Deborah Whiteplume, who passed away this past November, born and raised in Pine Ridge Reservation, South Dakota. She helped lead the fight against fossil fuel extraction and oil and gas pipelines. In 2016, we spoke with her at a protest camp in the Standing Rock Reservation in North Dakota, where she joined water defenders fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline. This is some of what she said.
If the pipeline is put in, it's going to leak or spill or burst or explode, and that oil is going to get into the water. And Dakota Access Pipeline says they're going to bury it 30 feet under, and they're assuring everybody that it's going to be safe. But I think Western science doesn't really know everything it thinks it knows, and we need to make our decisions based on what's best for Mother Earth and our coming generations. And that includes protecting our water. Water is under threat all over the world. Right now, there are people who have no access to clean drinking water.
That's Deborah Whiteplume. We met her at the Standing Rock Reservation. Alex Whiteplume of the Oglala Sioux Tribe. Can you talk about her commitment to stopping the Dakota Access Pipeline?
Yeah.
I'm so sorry on your loss, Alex. It's hard for me to, I know, to play the video. You relive your wife.
I think, I remember a time when she said, "Whiteplume, come in here. I want to talk to you about something serious." So I was outside working on the yard, and I came in, and she says, "You know, I'm going to fight against cancer. These mining companies are destroying our water, and I developed a plan. It's going to take me 25 years to take on the largest uranium mining company in the world, which was Cameco Incorporated, and to have a mining company at Crow Butte, Nebraska, just 20 miles from our border." And she says, "Can I have you support me? I need you to stand by me. This is going to be a long fight." And so I agreed, naturally. And so what she did was she done a lot of research, and she attacked them where they were the weakest, and that is the permitting process. She didn't just say, "We're going to go out and fight the mining company and go rabble-rouse and everything." She done studies, and she found out where they were going to apply and their permitting. So it took her 25 years, but she shut down the uranium mine. Well, about 10 years before, KXL pipeline was coming down.
We just have 10 seconds, Alex.
They were going through the permitting process, so she attacked them, and then that's how we shut them down the first time, was through the permitting process. You just can't take these millionaire corporations on. They have tons of money and lawyers. So she was real strategized. She always used strategy. Well, she didn't just go out for nothing. But
Jody,
thank you very much for having on here.
Can you tell us if the Biden administration is weighing now what to do with DAPL?
I believe that they are, and I think that they understand that this is a risk that the Energy Transfer Partners knew that they were taking. Energy Transfer Partners said that they spent $7.5 billion. This has to be a statement. If the Biden administration stands for racial justice and equity, if they stand for climate justice—
3 seconds.
When are we going to have justice in Standing Rock? When
Jody
are we going
Archambault
to have the ability
and Alex
to have clean
thanks
water?
For joining us. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.